say goodbye to another great group of residents and say hello to a new crop of attendings. Congrats to all of our 3 and 5 year grads for making it out into the real world. As a parting gift, we here at AZMCast wanted to give you a little present. You may have heard there's this thing called board certification that's coming up this year. Those in-training exams you've done every year? Yeah, those are to prep you for this. So you've got it made, right? You've been practicing, doing well on the tests? Not really. Once you pass that, then there's the oral boards in all of its glory. But then, you're in the clear. But not really. Then there's maintenance of certification, and the LLSA, and CME, and all the abbreviations that you have to fulfill in order to maintain your board certification. We're going to help you navigate it with the help of one of ABEM's newest board members, Dr. Sam Kime. So listen to it now, listen to it later. If you're an intern or a junior, put it on the back burner and come back and listen to it when it's your time. But for now, welcome to your new career and congratulations to all of our seniors. So it's a nice monsoony day here in Tucson, and my boss, Dr. Sam Kime, walked all the way across in the rain to record the podcast today. So thank you, Sam, for coming.
Thank you, Aaron, and let me correct you. You are my boss as chair of this department. I'm serving these wonderful faculty, and you are an especially worthy faculty member.
Thank you much. I appreciate it. I have that on record now. It's recorded, so I'm going to play that when I need a little confidence boost. So Dr. Kime is our department head here in Tucson, and he is also, as of early this spring, one of the new board of directors for the American Board of Emergency Medicine for ABEM, which almost all of you that are listening are going to or have been involved with ABEM. This is what we're training you to do, is to be able to become ABEM certified doctors. So Dr. Kime was kind enough to give a parting gift to our graduating senior class and to those of you that have graduated to discuss a little bit about board certification, not only how to get there, but also how to maintain it once you're out.
Actually, I become a board of director at the summer meeting about the 18th of July. That's when I learned the secret handshake and the special password.
You get your decoder ring?
That's right.
Fantastic.
But until then, I am not officially a board of director. I've been elected, but I don't start my eight-year term until mid-July. But I have been volunteering, as many of our faculty have, for ABEM activities. I'm an oral examiner. I'm also an item writer for the questions.
So I'd like for you to talk a little bit about board certification. It's a lengthy process. Once you've completed an accredited emergency medicine residency, there are several steps that we do to make sure that you're board certified. So I'd like to give you a little time, if you could, just to comment on a little of the history of how this came about and why it's so important to be board certified.
Sure. Well, board certification is how we distinguish an individual who has the skill set, knowledge, attributes of a specialist in emergency medicine from someone who doesn't. And so prior to the existence of ABEM, it was the wild, wild west. There was really no clear way to designate who had specialty expertise and who didn't. So that really is, in a nutshell, the purpose of board certification, and is the same with other specialties as well. So the American Board of Medical Specialties has a very explicit process by which specialties become boards, and then how they behave. And I can tell you right from the beginning, ABEM has distinguished itself among all the member boards of the ABMS as a best practice gold standard. It's not uncommon for members of the other boards, American Board of Surgery, American Board of Pediatrics, to visit ABEM during its meetings to witness how this best practice activity works. So I can tell you, ABEM functions at the very top of functionality of a not-for-profit and the way they conduct business. So 40 years ago, members of the American College of Emergency Physicians decided to take donations from their members to put together a board, because at that time there was no way to distinguish a true specialist in emergency medicine from someone who just said they were but didn't have the skills and competencies, attitudes, whatever, that would be justifiable as a specialist. So ABEM began in 1979 as a what we call a conjoint board, meaning it was basically on probation. 10 years after that, 1989, we gained independence. We proved that we were capable of running business ourselves and became an independent primary board. And so most of the residents and even junior faculty, maybe you, have taken it for granted that we have this specialty of emergency medicine that's dignified and legitimate, it's bona fide. You know, I get my residency done, I take this exam or these two exams, I guess, and then I'm done. And we'll find out during this podcast that there's a little more to it than that. But a lot of work, a lot of great design and implementation and assessment has gone into the last 40 years to bring us to this point where we are looked at by the other specialties in medicine as the gold standard.
And to kind of distinguish, there's a little bit of an alphabet soup once you get out. There's ABEM, there's ASEP, there's AAEM. ABEM is not a college. It's not so much of a group, an advocacy, as it is somebody that is trying to make sure that board-certified emergency doctors are well-qualified to staff emergency departments throughout the country.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a society. It's not a social network. It's a not-for-profit organization whose stated mission is to ensure the highest standards in the specialty of emergency medicine. So pure and simple, it's the certification standard setting body. So how do we standardize what an emergency physician is, and what quality level should that individual have?
ABEM starts really even during residency, as we prepare you all through the in-training exam. That one exam, you went from medical school where you took an exam maybe every couple months for a clerkship, and now you only take an exam every year, which is good if you don't like exams, but it's also bad if you don't like exams, because you get one a year to kind of practice for this test. There are two parts to getting initial board certified. The first one is you take your written exam, which you sign up for. It's your senior year, sometime in the spring. You pay up, study up, schedule your time to take your exam, and then you sit for your writtens. ABEM has kind of a practice scenario on their website so that you can see how the test will unfold, very similar to how you did your USMLEs.
I'd say the first step for the resident contemplating post-residency and qualifying for ABEM certification is to get on the ABEM website. You can get on it now. In fact, I believe as soon as your program coordinator registers your demographic information, you actually have a personal website on ABEM sometime during your first year of your residency. But almost all the information on the ABEM website is available to the public. It's not secured in any way. So far more information than you need, actually. But it's all the frequently asked questions are actually there on the ABEM website. And certainly, before your final year, your third year, you should be very familiar with the ABEM website and the dates and the fees and those sort of things. During the last quarter of your third year, your final year, you should complete all your initial certification application materials, and my recommendation is pay that fee. It's currently $420. There are late fees that go into effect if you don't complete that early. And also, once you complete your application and you pay your fee, you're assigned an ABEM number, and your seating in the exams is prioritized based on that number. So there's a very strong advantage if you want to get through this process expeditiously to do that as soon as you get these application materials, so probably sometime in March or April of your final year. July 1st through August 1st, there's a late fee. So today, June 30th, that we're recording this, is the last day you can get in without a late fee, you guys. You seniors probably aren't going to hear this today. So oops, if you haven't. And then after that, you will be seated for the written exam, as you mentioned. But we actually call that the QE, the qualifying exam. So it's common jargon name is the written, but you'll find out that the ABEM folks won't call it that. We're you know, well-trained to call it by its trademarked name, the qualifying exam. And the qualifying exam, hopefully, you only have to take once. You take it to qualify you for all the steps that follow after that, and that test is done at a, you know, computer testing center in your location of choice.
So sorry to interject here, but I had to tell you a story. I took two board exams, pediatrics and emergency medicine, in the same year, and they were separated by about a month apart. I took pediatrics first, showed up early for my 8 a.m. pediatric written board exam, and I passed, and I was ecstatic. I went home, I got ready for the next month when I would take my emergency medicine board exam, showed up to the same testing center early to make sure I was ready, only to find out that they don't do the emergency medicine boards at that testing facility. No, they do it at the testing facility a mile down the road at 7 a.m. I had the nightmare that I've had for years of showing up to the test late. I might as well have been in my underwear. When I got there, the person running the desk was kind enough to still let me take it, but I showed up 45 minutes late to my emergency medicine boards. Don't do that.
And it's done on a specific date, so you do get assigned a date when you have to do this. But that exam is an independent fee, so hopefully you have some credit or you have some cash reserved. Of course, you've all been saving your money during residency and not spending it, because that fee is currently at $1,225, and that's in addition to the original $420 for your initial application. So let me double check that number. Excuse me, the QE is $960. My bad. It's $960 unless you register for it late. So $960 on top of the original $420. So you take that exam. You will hopefully pass that. Better than 90% of individuals from this residency program have passed that on the first try. That's pretty much a national standard. And then you are qualified to take the oral exam.
Once you've passed your written boards, the next step is to schedule your oral boards. And the oral boards, I think, are what more people are a little nebulous about. Well, what is this process? Most residencies, and our residency certainly, have done the mock oral boards so that you get an idea of the format. ABEM recently changed the format to where it's a lot more of a computer-based format, where you'll have a scenario with a monitor there that's laid out for you, and the examiner will sit there and kind of feed you some information. But this testing format is something we're trying to get you more used to. Again, on the ABEM website, they have a lot of information about how this oral boards proceeds. But this is kind of a unique thing. It's not every day that 100 people fly to the Chicago O'Hare Marriott and stay overnight and then get up in suits and wait patiently for their test. So if you don't mind, I'm going to say my experiences a little bit, Dr. Keim, about going out there. So you have two opportunities. You can schedule in the spring or you can schedule in the fall. And ABEM will send you an email about when you will be scheduled. And at that point, you buy your tickets and everyone goes to the Chicago O'Hare Marriott or one of its surrounding affiliates and waits to do their boards. You wake up early. If you're smart, you order breakfast to be delivered to your room so that you don't have to go anywhere and you can just sit there and relax before your test. And everybody waits. They explain the rules. And you go up to a floor, and there's a bunch of people sitting in the lobby by the elevator. And they're all nervously looking at each other. One person tries to crack a joke. Nobody laughs. As the day progresses, everybody... They tried. I tried very hard. By the end of the day, the jokes are funnier. And really, after the first oral boards case, you go, okay, I can do this. I did a residency. I've done this in real life. This shouldn't be scary. From there, you walk down the hall when they call your name. You wait in front of a room, and everyone goes into a hotel room at the same time. And there's a desk there, and there's a bed there, and there's a bathroom there, just like a normal hotel room. And someone is sitting there. You'll get to meet them. You may recognize them, you may not, but it should not be somebody that you've ever worked with at your residency program. They're very good with that. How many board examiners do we have on our faculty here? I saw one of our faculty when I was taking my oral boards. I acknowledged them with a brief head nod, and that was about it. So, and then afterwards said, hey, how'd it go? Yeah, exactly. So you do a few cases. Several of the cases are one patient, and then a couple of the cases are three patients at once. You have to practice these. You have to practice these ideally with someone who has done the boards and really someone who's done them recently. We have a few of our faculty, like I mentioned, that are oral board examiners. These are not people that you can practice your oral boards with. They clearly have a conflict of interest. However, our faculty have taught us very well how to take care of patients. So knowing that I have oral board examiners teaching me how to care for real patients makes me more comfortable for the oral boards. Once you've completed all this, there's a morning and an afternoon session. If you're lucky enough to get to the morning session, you finish up, everybody feels good, you go to the hotel bar, have lunch, and look at all the poor people in the afternoon session sitting in their suits waiting to go, knowing that you're done. I actually enjoyed it because I got to see some friends from residency that I hadn't seen in a while, and everybody congregates, has a good time.
Let me add a couple of comments. That's very, very nice overview of your personal experience, Aaron. You will be given a date assigned, like you said, either fall or spring, to go to Chicago. It is only given at the Chicago O'Hare Marriott, has been given there for over 25 years. I've been there for about 20 years, and I can tell you I get deja vu every time I go in there, but it works. The staff there are great. The rooms are all set up for us, and it works like a Swiss watch.
So how many other boards do oral boards? We're one of the few that actually require that our residents do oral boards. Is that correct?
That's correct. No one does an oral board like we do. There are a few that have oral experience where they actually have to present a case of their own or five cases of their own and tell, explain to the examiner why they manage the case a certain way. But ABEM is clearly the only board that has basically a simulation. This is a virtual reality of a real case as close as we can make it. And it's been applauded by independent exam evaluation experts as a true, best practice, best method.
I'll tell you, having done two boards, if I had to do a pediatric oral exam and get down on the floor with the examiner and talk baby talk, that'd be very embarrassing. I'm pretty sure I could pass a peds oral exam, but I'm glad I don't have to.
But you know, a misconception is that the examiners do some sort of virtual simulation or act out as a patient. They do not do that. We are specifically trained not to do that. So if your faculty are doing that during your oral case simulations at your residency, that's actually not accurate. We don't do that. We're trained to be a tool of the board and just present the information, and there really is no gamesmanship.
For those of you that are here in Tucson and you know John Sackles, just imagine John Sackles in every single room.
Mm-hmm.
And if all goes well, you receive an email a few months later that you are now a board certified emergency physician. Good job. And then it's over for 10 years, right?
No.
Not even close. So, Most of the emergency departments where you're going to work are going to want you to be board certified. Sam, if I can ask you to comment real quick about the board certification, they'll want you to be board certified or board eligible. But board eligibility is also changing.
More or less. So the ABMS, the parent of all the professional boards, has decided that there should be a time limit to the amount of time that passes from completion of residency to when board certification actually happens, and the ABMS has decided that should be 5 years. And so you have 5 years to basically initiate this process and get it going. You don't have to be completed in 5 years, is my understanding, but you have to get it going. So, and that would just, in my opinion, be a mistake to delay it any longer than necessary. There must be a really, really good reason, a personal life event, to prevent you from just going straight into it, because that's when you're going to have your greatest chance for successful passing, is right after you finish your residency, and you're really probably at your smartest, at your best at doing these exams. That's what they're validated to assess, is right after you finished residency. So board eligibility is now an official term. It actually was not an official term in the American Board of Emergency Medicine until this recent decision policy. People use the term board eligible, but the board never really used the term. So now it is an official term. You're board eligible for up to 5 years following residency. Again, recommend you go straight through, take care of it, do it.
So once you become board certified, there's now the maintenance of certification, the MOC. And as Sam said, if you go to the ABEM website, abem.org, this sounds like a commercial, but because this is not just a nice thing to have, it's a very important, key, crucial thing to have. I hope you enjoy the commercial. You go to the website, and it will tell you a huge list of things that you're supposed to be doing during this time. So it's not just a test every 10 years. There are things that you need to be doing in between. And the few things we'll talk about, one is the LLSA. The second is what to do with CME. I know that's lots of questions, because during residency, you don't really have to do CME, but once you get out, you do. And the IMP, the Improvement in Medical Practice. And finally, the CONCERT exam. So these are kind of the big four things they want you to do. And you have 10 years to get these complete. And many of these, you have to do a certain amount within the first 5 years and then in the second 5 years. So somebody gets done with their boards, they take that year, they've studied hard, and then what would you recommend they start getting into to make sure they don't fall behind with maintenance of certification?
So first, the overall goal of maintenance of certification is to ensure the public that these specialists that we've now certified are actually continuing their education. They're doing lifelong learning. They're not just resting on their laurels and resting on their residency education. This is maintenance of certification, again, is required for all the boards. It's not just emergency medicine. It's a really good idea, in my opinion. Much of residency should be spent learning how to acquire knowledge and then translate that to patient care. We don't want you to stop. We want you to continue that throughout your career. And the LLSA, the Lifelong Learning Self-Assessment Tests, that program is designed exactly for that activity. That is to keep up on the practice of emergency medicine, the clinical practice of emergency medicine, and then the annual tests that you will take that are open book, online. You can do them in a number of ways. They're very reasonable. Is a way to assess that you've actually done this activity. So it's a very user-friendly process. You can get CME credit for doing the LLSA readings and activity. You have to pay a fee for a CME activity anywhere, and you do on this in this situation as well. But I highly recommend that step one is to get on the website, find out what the LLSA articles are, start reading them, and then once you're certified, of course, and then you can take these exams. You can take them as a group activity. Pass those exams. There's basically one activity per year, and you can think of these 10-year periods of time broken into two blocks, two 5-year blocks. And it gets complicated, so you have to get on your website, your personalized website, and find out where you are after you're board certified, and they will tell you. It's very user-friendly. You know, Aaron, you must do this activity this year. You can take more than one exam or one LLSA activity in a given year because these articles and these exams are live, if you will, for multiple years before they're retired. So you could, for example, do two or three LLSA exams and activities in a single year. You have 5 years to complete, you know, four activities. So they give you kind of a year off, but I recommend you just do one, just get used to doing one every year.
So I logged into my ABEM website. Please don't look at it.
Even you could do that.
Yeah, even I could do that. So to give you an idea, the LLSA, they grab a group of articles that are current and found to be best practice, things that you should know about. So this may seem a little bit straightforward to those of you that are in residency. We're going to talk about issues related to pre-hospital epi and survival and out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, about therapeutic hypothermia, about cardiovascular disasters in pregnancy. These are some of the things that they're going to go over. Another one, new oral anticoagulants. These are things we talk about all the time in residency. But once you get out, unless you actually take the time to get together with colleagues, do a journal club, you know, make sure you're discussing this, it's easy to fall behind if you're not putting in the effort to continue your learning. And this is stuff that those of you that have even been in residency for 3 years know that there's been a lot of changes in the last 3 years. So you have to keep up with it. So the LLSA is nice in that they give you a set of articles to go over, you read it, and then you sign up for the test. I just did one of the tests. It's $100 to do the test, and then it's $30 extra to get the CME, which is a pretty good deal. And that's something they actually require, is that some of your CME comes from self-assessment. So it's a pretty good deal to do. You have to do four of them the first 5 years, four of them the second 5 years, and it's all spelled out on your initial page. So this is to help you keep up with what the experts are saying are the most important, some of the most important articles or at least topics in emergency medicine right now.
Yeah, you nailed it, Aaron. That's exactly right. The only thing I would add is, and this might be a good way to cover this, is that every 10 years, one of these LLSA activities must be focused on patient safety. And that's an explicit activity that's spelled out on the website. So in place of one of these annual LLSA activities, you will do a patient safety activity. And that one has a specific pretest you take. It has a set of readings and then a lecture that's actually videotaped, and then you do a post-test. And that has just recently been remodeled and updated and is very user-friendly. And just one of the activities over the 10 years has to be patient safety.
So in doing these LLSAs, some of the self-assessment you can get CME credit, and that's required for some of your CME. So CME, continuing medical education, you can't just get CME anywhere. It has to be a specific kind of CME. It has to be AMA, PRA, Category 1 credit. So make sure that you look for that, just like you read the ingredients labels to see if there, you know, how many calories from fat there is. Make sure that your CME is chock full of AMA, PRA, Category 1 credit. Having done some CME stuff, the process is pretty rigorous. You have to sign a lot of waivers saying I don't have conflicts of interest. I have to submit my objectives. There has to be some kind of assessment at the end of it. You have to put some effort into it. You can't just say, hey, come over to my house. We'll serve you dinner, and you pay me some money, and I'll tell you what I know. That's not going to be adequate. You can't say, hey, come to Barbados. We'll do some scuba diving, and we'll talk about sea life. And by the way, I'll give you some CME credit. There has to be some effort put into it. Although, if you can get to Barbados, I think that's probably a good deal. So CME credit, you need to have at least, on average, 25 credits per year, and some of them must be self-assessment. So one of the nice things to keep all this stuff together, they'll give you certificates for here's the CME that you got that's pediatrics or it's trauma or it's OB-GYN. Your hospital might actually require you to have certain kinds of CME depending on where you work. When I was doing some pediatric stuff at another hospital, they needed me to do 8 credit hours of lactation to maintain my pediatric CME in the emergency department. You can imagine how often I use that, but they will actually tell you what you have and what this what the CME activity was related to. ASEP, the American College of Emergency Physicians, has a great CME tracker that they will you can upload your CME and they will keep track of it for you. So if you're already a member of ASEP, you can upload some of your CME certificates and they'll keep track of how you're doing, what you did. It's kind of nice to have that report as well. You can print it out, give it to your hospital.
That's right. Any CME that any AMA approved CME credit that you earn for any other purpose counts toward ABEM, and you don't have to get it all in 1 year. So you could do 50 in 1 year and zero in the next year. You have to have 25 credits average per year over the block of time. And by the way, this is a requirement where you attest. You basically will check a box, a signature online that you've done this, and only need to verify this if you're randomly selected for an audit. But I highly recommend you save all your certificates, you scan them, keep them in a folder, keep them somewhere, ASEP tracker somewhere, because if you are randomly selected, you'll have to prove and document that you did attend.
So this part, I think most people have heard about CME. They know that this is something they need to do. All this stuff you've done during residency, it doesn't count going to conference for CME. But once you get out, you have to start keeping track of it. The LLSA, it's a test that makes, you know, you need to keep up to date on articles. The next one is the improvement in medical practice, the patient care practice improvement and the patient feedback. These have to do with a couple things ABEM really values. They value professionalism, they value communication, and they value the patient feedback and how well you're doing, that you're trying to improve your practice on an annual, hopefully a monthly and a daily basis, that you're saying, what can I do better? But this can be something that's a little more nebulous. They have some good answers on the frequently asked questions. But Sam, could you comment a little bit about what ABEM's looking for with these activities, the patient care practice improvement and the patient feedback?
So almost all of these activities are already being done by your department or by your group when you finish residency and join a group. Our group definitely does these. We do quite a few quality improvement activities. Lisa Chan and Matt Berkman are involved in quality improvement activities, and actually our department participates in a vast number of these for trauma center accreditation, stroke center accreditation, the pediatric center accreditation, and just general good hospital practice. So, you know, door to doc times, door to pain medicine time, door to, balloon time for STEMIs. All these things are quality improvement activities that count toward your ABEM requirement. And it's perfectly fine for you to attest. And again, this is an attestation. You're not going to have to send anything in. You're going to attest every 5 years that you did a quality improvement, patient improvement activity. And there will be someone who is a verifier for you. Our practice administrator, Dale Borgeson, is our faculty verifier. So if ABEM would randomly select the faculty at the University of Arizona to audit on their quality improvement activity, they would contact Dale Borgeson and he would provide the evidence that we have been participating on these activities, and we would kill it. We do far more than the requirement. And so every 5 years you have to attest once that you've done a practice improvement activity. And then same with communication, professionalism. If your group, and essentially everybody does this now because CMS and JCO do it for you, they require it. have a communication activity going on. So we have a press gainy type patient survey that is done, and that is perfectly acceptable. It's probably the most common activity that's reported by emergency physicians to aid them for this requirement. And again, you simply attest that you're participating as a group member in these activities once every 5 years.
So being a good citizen where you work, taking good care of patients, and being concerned about your patient's feedback, how are you doing? That's what you have to do. That's what ABM wants you to do. And so if you, when you get a new job, when you join a new group, this may be something to ask. If say, hey, what do you do to help me with my board certification as far as improvement in medical practice? What are some of the things you're involved in? And if you ask that question, they may say, well, let me tell you, because we're going to have you help out. Not the worst thing in the world, okay? It's good to know how this stuff works. It's good to know how you can make patient care better. That's what we're here to do. But that's an important thing to know. How does your group actually accomplish this? You can do this as a group. You don't necessarily have to go out and call every 10th patient to see how you did. Maintenance of licensure is one of the other parts for professionalism. This is get a license where you have. Don't get it suspended or revoked. Don't sell Percocets out of the trunk of your car. Don't have an inappropriate relationship with your patients. Don't do anything to get your license suspended. And if you keep that up, that's what ABM wants you to do.
Exactly, Aaron. I would add a few comments here, editorial comments, that you know, it is not a trivial challenge to maintain an unrestricted license. A state medical board can investigate you and sanction you and restrict your license for a vast variety of behaviors that many residents would consider probably acceptable. The listener might not, but some residents might. So intoxication in public could be reported by a witness to that behavior who happens to know that you're a physician. They write a letter to the board. The board investigates that. I have seen that happen before. They do the investigation and find that the behavior is unprofessional and not consistent with the standards for the board, and they give you some sort of restriction. That is a very significant thing, right? So then ABM, and you have to report to ABM, you have to report to your hospital medical staff that you've now been given a restriction of some sort. And that could be, you know, you have to drop urines, you have to attend AA meetings in addition to that. But if you don't self-report to your hospital medical staff and ABM, you could lose credentials and you could lose your certification. So this is not a trivial thing to spend some time thinking about. Hospitals now have core behaviors. If you're not, if you think an inappropriate joke is perfectly fine and someone reports you, the next thing you know, the medical staff is investigating you for a breach of core behaviors. They report you to the National Physician Practitioner Database, and voila, you've got some serious challenges. So I think it's worth spending some time thinking about professionalism and what you do at work and what you don't do at work, because ABM does have this clause that you must have a full and unrestricted license in all the states that you have a license. So there are people that have a licensure in multiple states. I'm not sure why, but I guess they go moonlight at these other sites. But if you have a restriction in the state of Texas, no restriction in the state of Arizona, that restriction in the state of Texas will cause your board certification to be challenged.
So filling out letters of recommendation for people that are trying to get jobs and having done the credentialing packets, it's a lot. It's a lot to fill out. And if you have to report that you had your license restricted, suspended, revoked, however it is, you're going to have to report that on every single application for credentialing, which generally happens every 2 years at a hospital, and your licensure happens every 2 years as well. You have to report that every time. So it's not just an inconvenience. It's not just embarrassing. It's can be real trouble. So it's not, and I think the most striking thing is what you commented on. It's not just what you've done at work. It's not just that you made a bad mistake at work. You made a bad mistake outside. You got arrested for a DUI. You had something happen that's going to affect your licensure. What's one more thing is that for most states, your medical licensure, where you went to school, where you did residency, whether or not you're board certified, and if you have any complaints, is available to the general public at any time online. So this is something to be very considerate of what your profession is. You are a professional and should behave like a professional in order to maintain good standing.
I was just amazed, Aaron, that you have an unrestricted license.
You and me both. So you've done all of these things, you've made it through 10 years, and it's time for your next test. You have the CONCERT exam. This is going to be the test every 10 years that you take for the rest of your career, as long as you're doing so, at this stage, in order to maintain your board certification. So the CONCERT exam is something you have to do. You can't do it in the first 5 years. You do it about 6 to 10 years after. Very similar to your qualifying exam, very similar to your in-training exam, very similar to your board exams that you've done in the past. It's something you do have to schedule, you have to take. Now, I have not yet made it this far, so what information can you tell us about the CONCERT exam, even though that seems like a lifetime away to many of our graduates?
We'll have some good news for you, Aaron. You don't have to wait till 10 years. You can actually take your CONCERT exam early.
Fantastic.
And if you do take it early and you don't pass it for some reason, your certification won't lapse. So it's actually not a bad idea to try maybe in your eighth year. Then you have 2 years to retake it and not have your certification lapse. If you wait for the full 10 years, take the CONCERT exam and not pass it, your certification actually could lapse, and that could put you into some jeopardy with your medical staff because they may require board certification. So taking it a year or two early, I think, is a recommended practice. And then you don't get a shortened cycle of certification because you took it early. So you pass at year eight. That doesn't mean you have 10 years from that point. You have 10 years from your original date. So for 12 years, you could go out after passing it in year eight of your first cycle. So the CONCERT exam is different than the qualifying exam, the original written exam. It is written by a unique team of item writers that are completely different than the writers for the original qualifying exam. The intent is to write questions that are relevant to the practicing emergency physician who has been out in practice for 10 years. It is not written to test a lot of basic science and underlying principles of the specialty that you might get in your original qualifying exam. These are very clinically valid, clinically relevant items. My recommendation when people ask me what should I do to study for the CONCERT exam is nothing. If you're practicing full-time clinical emergency medicine, that's your study method.
So no one's going to make me draw the carbon ring structure of benzocaine like on tox.
That's correct.
Fantastic.
I'm sure there's some really good tox questions, but that won't be one of them.
So at this point, we reset. 10 years in, you start all over. You start your LLSAs again. You start your CME again. You continue your improvement in medical practice, and you maintain your licensure and your professionalism. And this is now your career. Congratulations to those of you that are out. We look forward to working with you as board-certified emergency physicians. This is what you've waited your whole life for. This is what you did 23 years of school for. When you factor in medical school and residency, that's a long time to be in school. So enjoy it. It's been worth it, I hope. And maintaining your certification will help you maintain a long and prosperous career. Any other parting comments, Dr. Keim?
Yeah, I guess I'd add a few comments about some recent controversies that have happened with another board. The American Board of Internal Medicine is getting a lot of press these days. Unfortunately, I think it's very clear to me, and I can tell you this, I'm not yet on the board, that ABEM is different. Its construct is different. Its practice is different than the American Board of Internal Medicine. ABEM definitely behaves in a best practice method. All these exams, all these LLSA activities are very carefully designed. They're very carefully implemented. They're very carefully evaluated. If something isn't working, it's remodeled, either thrown out or re-implemented in a better fashion. Patient safety is a good example of it. It was originally launched several years ago. Quick feedback was that it wasn't working very well. It was eliminated, remodeled, and now has been relaunched. And that will continue to be ABEM's style. They're a learning organization. They really, truly are a best practice organization in every sense of the word. Those people that have volunteered for ABEM have a universal, I guess, adoration for the professionalism that happens inside that organization. Very unlike other organizations that we work with on a daily basis. It's just a great, I guess, privilege to be part of that organization. So I think you can trust that this process is fair. It's meaningful. ABEM certification means that you really are a true specialist in emergency medicine, and the public acknowledges that and are aware of that. It has true value.
Well, this presentation has been brought to you not by the American Board of Emergency Medicine, but by me, who wanted to make sure I stay board certified. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.